I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that nobody wants dementia. And most of us feel like it's a crapshoot. Maybe it's genetic, maybe it's lifestyle. There's a lot of confusing information out there. But my guest today, Dr. Mitchell Kliansky and his wife, Emily, have written a book called Dementia Prevention, Using Your Head to Save Your Brain. Who knew that we could actually do things to prevent dementia at any age, really? But the sooner we get started, the better. We had a great conversation about so many facets of our choosing, our lifestyle, our choices, as well as what we came in with, our genetics, how they influence the health of our brain, the function of our brain. And I think you'll be surprised by some of them. I know I was. So have a listen. Please share this really important information with friends and family. And I thank you for listening, as usual. This is the Rebellious Wellness Over 50 podcast. I'm Greg Cox, your host, and I believe it's time to bust the myth that aging equals decline or irrelevance. Nonsense. Aging happens, but it doesn't have to ruin your life. Each week, you'll hear experts who think and practice outside the box of conventional wisdom on how to age in good health so you can live fully expressed. I'm here to bust myths, help you embrace change, and live life your way. If you feel like the best of life has passed, it's time to get a little rebellious in your approach. Okay, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Rebellious Wellness Over 50. My guest today is Mitchell Kliansky, and we are going to talk about dementia prevention. Super excited to have this conversation because in my work with women who are mainly my clients are in their mid-60s and older, we all have a fear of dementia. We're going to find out today how it is possible to prevent dementia, because I know we hear eat well, live well, that kind of thing, and you can lower your risks, but I think a lot of us don't believe it. So Dr. Kliansky, thank you for being here. We look forward to hearing from you about this.
My pleasure, Greg. It's really nice to be able to talk about this and with an audience that I'm sure is both concerned, but probably motivated to do some of the things that have been demonstrated scientifically to reduce your risk of dementia.
Yeah.
You know, 80% of people over the age of 50 are somewhat or very worried about dementia. And that can be paralyzing if all you do is worry. That's why when we talk about in the book that don't be a dementia worrier, become a prevention warrior. There's a very active approach that is based on real science. We're not talking about just, oh, I have a friend who told me this, or I saw a commercial about that. We're talking about large science where we're really looking at the kind of published research that has been replicated from all kinds of different areas. Because when Emily, my wife, and I started looking at this research, she's a physician, a psychiatrist, and an internal medicine doctor, both. I'm a neuropsychologist, so I study how the brain influences how we think. We realized that we couldn't just look in neurology, we couldn't just look in psychiatry or neuropsychology, but rather there was important information from fields like cardiology, endocrinology, especially diabetes, looking at exercise physiology, looking at pulmonology, breathing science, looking at sleep medicine. It's really in many, many different ways. So our goal was to sample the real science in each of these areas, pull it together in an organized framework, translate it into terms that people could really understand, the kind of terms that we talk with our patients about one-to-one. So we understand what people get, what they don't get. And if you just talk over their heads, you might as well just be whistling in the wind because it won't matter at all. People need to get it. They need to understand what's going on and how their body works. And then to motivate them to do a self-analysis and say, here's where I got strengths. Here's where I've got weaknesses. Here's what I can do to change my brain's future. And that's really what it's about, making a difference in your brain's future.
I love that phrase. And it kind of gives it, it almost gamifies it. It's like, I have a future, but my brain is the big part of I. Because even if our brain doesn't work, some of our physical attributes are not going to work as well, right? If we end up with a stroke or if we end up with dementia, and that has, so I'm I love that you were saying we had to pull all of these different areas of science together, because it isn't just the brain. You know, it's like they say, the ankle bones connected to the whatever that used to be. Of course, our brain is connected to our body. And if one thing isn't staying healthy and active, the other part's probably not also going to do as well, right?
Yeah. And the other thing is, I tell people there are no dementiologists. Strange when you think about it. There's cardiologists for your heart. There's endocrinologists for how your hormones and other regulatory systems work. There's all these ologists, but there aren't any dementiologists. There are people who do this as part of their practice in other areas. And that's what we really need in some ways, is an integrated approach to this. And one of the reasons why I believe that we have not cured dementias of all types, not just Alzheimer's, but vascular dementia and frontotemporal dementia and dementias due to head trauma, dementias due to alcoholism, is that there isn't a single entity. It really is a combined focus from many different areas.
So gerontology is the bigger context of at the times that people more likely get dementia is as we age. Yes.
Right.
So I'm thinking gerontology is for older human beings. So maybe they have a little bit of that in their.
Well, they do have some of it. Sure. Yeah. And they're also looking at bone density, and they're also looking at postmenopausal hormonal changes. Mm. They're also looking at how you adjust the dosage of a prescribed medication, which was originally developed based on somebody who was 35 years old and male, to now adapt it to a woman who's in her 70s. So they do a lot of that kind of work, and it's good work, but it doesn't really focus on dementia. In fact, you know, they, like many physicians, are more likely than not to take a complaint of forgetfulness and rationalize it away. Because that's what happens all the time, is you go into your doctor and said, you know, sort of worried. Is this sort of normal aging? Should I be forgetting people's names? Should I be searching for words? Why did I leave that coffee cup for 3 days in my office and not be able to find it? I thought I had it with me. All those kinds of senior moment things. And oftentimes the physicians who may be close to or the same age as their patients will say, oh, don't worry about it. I do the same thing. Now, if you went to the doctor and say, I've just got this productive cough, your doctor would be unlikely to say, yeah, I've got the same thing sometimes. Don't worry about it. Right. They would say, let's work it up. If you were saying, you know, I'm worried about my blood pressure, they'd go ahead and slap a sphygmomanometer on your arm, a blood pressure cuff. Right. And they'd say, let's measure it. They don't do that with cognition most of the time. Mm. And so they are left without a tool to estimate, is this a real concern? Is this something that this person's really depressed and that's why they're complaining? And so it's easier for them to sort of kick the can down the road than to really investigate it. And that's one of the areas we have to work on in medicine as a way of identifying changes in cognition early in the process, because we can do so much more at that point.
So who is a candidate for a diagnostic to see whether they're heading in that direction?
What we should be doing is, everybody is actually, and what we should be doing is using brief measures of general thinking ability, brief measures of cognition as a routine part of every annual wellness visit. Mm. So when you go in, like, really Medicare is the most likely place to start with this, because again, as you were saying before, most of the people with cognitive impairments due to dementia are over the age of 65. Right now, they do a very cursory job of this, and they're mostly based on complaints. That's not good, because people oftentimes should complain and they don't. And other times they complain when they really shouldn't, because it's normal. But what if you gave them a 5-minute test? And based on the 5-minute test, you could say, okay, you look pretty good right now. I'll see you again in a year. We'll test it again. Or you're beginning to pick up on some problems and said, maybe we should send you for some more extensive testing. Or what often happens is they do that testing and say, you know, you talk a good game, but your thinking isn't as good as I thought it was going to be. Let's work this up, because again, the earlier we start doing something, the better our outcomes.
Now, you have an online checklist. Is that a sort of an early warning system? If we went down the checklist and said, I have this, 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 and this, would they end up saying, oh, maybe I should go to a doctor?
Not, it's not designed for that, but you're right. It's an online, it's on our website called BrainDoc, BRAINDOC, BrainDoc.com. And it's free to download and fill out. The goal of the checklist is to give you a status report of where you are from a dementia prevention perspective, where you're on target, where you're off target, and where you're sort of in between, where you're near target. Mm-hmm. So it looks at 20 different questions that are going to give you a really a roadmap to what could I to reduce my risk of dementia. Because one in two cases, 50%, the science tells us, 50% of dementias are preventable.
Wow.
That's huge.
That is huge.
If we could say the same thing for cure, we would spend any kind of money whatsoever. Mm-hmm. But why are we waiting to first have it? Why aren't we spending our time and energies moving the candle away from the window where there's a drape rather than waiting for the fire trucks to arrive? Why are we not doing that?
Yeah.
It's sort of a crazy approach to things. It would yield so much benefit, cost so little in comparison. So part of my role, part of my mission in this is to try to shift attention toward prevention. Because mm-hmm. that's where we're going to save the money in the long run. That's where we're going to save lives. That's where we're not going to end up 20 years from now with one out of three people in this country either having dementia or caring for somebody with dementia. It has mm-hmm. to start early.
Yeah. Can you just give me a quick rundown of there's dementia, early stages. Dementia is not necessarily Alzheimer's, or maybe I have that wrong. Can you give us a brief categorization of those stages?
Yes, it's a great question. So dementia is an overall category. I use the example of automobiles. It's a car. Okay, so what kind of car is it? Is it a Ford? Is it a Toyota? Is it a Volkswagen? Is it a SUV or a compact car? What kind of car is it? When we say dementia, we're looking at a progressive decline in thinking and function that is neurologically based. So it's not due to psychiatric problems. It's due to a change in person's brain function. And it has these underlying categories. So instead of it being Chevrolet and Toyota, it has things like Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia being the most common two forms of dementia. And in many cases, it's actually a combination of both of those. Alzheimer's has gotten a lot of the publicity over the years. And there's a whole story that we talk about in the book about why that is. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's the most important or necessarily the one that should get all of our attention, because we may be actually able to do more with the other contributors than we are to the specifics of Alzheimer's. But you have vascular dementia. About 25% of people with Parkinson's disease have or will get dementia. Many people don't know that, but there's a common kind of underlying dementia there. We know that repeated head injuries and even sometimes a single significant head injury will dramatically increase the risks of getting dementia later on in our lives. We know that excess sugar in our bloodstream, diabetes will lead to, there's all these different underlying medical causes, which I'm happy to talk about. But the other kind of dementia, which is a little different from the ones I've described, is the Bruce Willis form of dementia, frontotemporal dementia, usually much earlier in terms of its onset, different in that memory is usually not the biggest symptom. Speech or behavior changes are the things that are the most likely to occur. And it probably does not share the same underlying pathology in many cases.
That sounds like maybe a genetic variant.
Something, I'm sure there are genetic parts to that. There's genetic parts to all
to everything,
to some extent, either directly. Like we know there's this thing called the APOE4 allele, which is an underlying variant that more likely increases your chance of Alzheimer's disease. But secondarily, there's also variants. For example, if you've got a lot of genes for cardiac disease, your chances of having vascular dementia go up quite a bit. Mm. Even though it's not a direct cause, it's the changes in your circulation, the changes in your heart health that are going to lead you to have a greater propensity to having problems as you age. But no matter what the genetics are, we can't change them.
Right.
I tell people it's like playing golf. You play it where it lays. Sometimes you're on the fairway. Sometimes you're in the rough. You may even be in the water hazard, but that's where you are right now. And the question is, what's the best way of getting out of it and getting back onto the fairway? I don't even play golf, but I love the analogies because they really do work.
Yeah. So the vascular dementia, how does that present differently? Because I'm thinking, let's go back for a second. Prevention. If somebody has vascular disease or heart disease or cardiopulmonary lung, how do you reverse that? But it's not about reversing, it's about preventing. So you would have to get somebody early before they got the vascular problems?
Not necessarily. It's always better to do it early. I mean, that's sort of a general rule.
Yeah.
The focus then is on control and maintenance. So for example, let's suppose you've got atrial fibrillation. You've got an irregular heartbeat that's usually very fast, but it can be irregular. And the doctor says, well, you got AFib. And they say, well, what can I do about that? Well, there are different things. You could, you know, have a cardioversion to put you back into normal rhythm. You could take some medications that would help with that. You could take some medications that will reduce the chances of throwing a blood clot, which will end up possibly causing a stroke. You could also get a surgical type of ablation where they go in and physically change the way in which your heart rhythm is regulated. Or you may simply say, I think the medication and exercise and maintaining my weight and controlling my blood pressure until proven otherwise will be good enough for me. Mm. And then you have to say, well, how regularly are you taking your blood pressure medications? Are you cutting out salt in your diet to reduce the likelihood that that may be adding to your blood pressure burden? Are you doing a good job of staying active physically? Because we know that almost for any of these things, exercise is an elixir. Mm-hmm. And if you can get people to take, I tell people, I want you to take a 10-minute walk. Mm-hmm. And they look at me and I say, yeah, I want you to 3 times a day. Here's why this will work. Number one, that's 30 minutes a day of exercise. Number two, that's 210 minutes a week. That's right in the sweet spot of what all the major health organizations are saying. They're saying 150 to 300. Mm-hmm. But number three, which is really the important thing, is it's hard to say no. It's only 10 minutes. What is your objection? Is it too hot for 10 minutes? No. Is it too cold for 10 minutes? Probably not. You're going to melt because it's wet outside for 10 minutes. Yeah, it can be too icy. Where I live here in Massachusetts, yeah, I don't want people going out and taking their walks.
Right, yeah.
But you have a hard time. You don't say, well, I don't have the equipment, but I don't belong to a gym. And, you know, my day is very busy. You work around all of those objections. And now you get a place you can start. Mm-hmm. And that's the key. It's getting around the objections because nobody argues with you when you say it's good to exercise. They just avert their eyes when you ask them, doing. Well, I should do more. And I'm planning on joining a gym. I always tell them, my mother's used to say that the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Oh, yeah.
Don't tell me what you're planning on doing. Tell right. me what you're doing. Yeah. That's where I want to start with you.
I had a client once. And there's also the 10 minutes after a meal kind of walk, you know.
That's a good one too.
Try to get your blood sugar. And she came back after a couple of weeks and I said, how's your walking going? And she said, well, I'm kind of mad at you. Why? Well, because I don't get anywhere in 10 minutes. So now I'm walking for like a half an hour so I can go see my neighbor. So it was just, it was just a little get started. Like you said, play it where it lays. Get started. Mm-hmm. See what happens. You might like it. So rather than doing 10 minutes more than once a day, she just did her whole half hour and she liked it. Yeah.
Good for her.
I love those kind of stories.
They sort of kick off automatically on you. It's so nice.
Yeah. And the thing that I find interesting is that little tiny bit of that one suggestion made a huge difference in the person's life. And so this podcast is really designed to give somebody listening maybe that one little bit of information that will kickstart something for their health for the future, because it's all about, I want people to age with freedom of mobility, of clarity, of that kind of thing. So tell me a little bit about the prevention program. What do we have to do besides walk 10 minutes now and again?
It depends on what your analysis shows. That's the whole idea. So doing the questionnaire, which is embedded in the book. Mm-hmm. So we start talking about what dementia is, what it isn't. We talk about the large-scale studies that have been done that show that 50%, anywhere 40 to 60 are the actual studies. So we say one out of two cases are preventable. And we go through the model that we build chapter by chapter. So we're looking at midlife cardiovascular conditions, diabetes, hypertension. Those are often fueled by smoking cigarettes, by sedentary behavior, by obesity. Those things all hang together. Mm-hmm. We talk about sleep and sleep disordered breathing. Turns out that breathing is a good thing.
You think?
I know.
You got science to prove that, Mitch?
I'm just going to take it on faith. But yeah, there is science about it, that especially while you're sleeping, we breathe pretty well mostly while we're awake. The question is, do we have a problem because we stop breathing or our oxygen level drops multiple times while we're asleep? Just 3 months ago, recent study was just published, 6,000 people in about five or six different centers across the United States. The Framingham Heart Study is one of the centers. Mm-hmm. These are all places where people sign up, people of the general population, they go in and they enroll to be studied every several years on a battery of tests. Mm-hmm. Well, they formed a consortium of these groups and decided they were going to give every single person in there, 6,000 of them, a one-night home sleep study. Oh. Painless, odorless test. You put on a device, it tells you what your numbers look like. And they found that if you're 58 years or older, that 50% of you have sleep apnea, that at least five times an hour, you stop breathing or your oxygen drops by four. This impacts our risk of heart attack, our risk of stroke, our risk of gout, of all things.
My goodness, that's an interesting
correlation. For men, particularly risk of erectile dysfunction, if you can get a man diagnosed with sleep apnea, 50% of the guys going to clinics to get those little blue pills have sleep apnea. You can fix the circulation, you're going to make a difference in how they function.
Yeah.
And also dramatically changes their risk of dementia. Mm. So we're real big on identifying something that is fixable or at least improvable to the point where it's going to give people energy and sleep continuity. Because it turns out the quality of our sleep and the depth of our sleep is also real important. Mm-hmm. So we look at that. Then we look at sensory and interpersonal function. So we look at, do you hear well enough? Because we know that hearing loss is associated with memory decline. Hmm. We know that visual loss, uncorrected, is a source of withdrawal and perhaps dementia. If you have both of those things going on and you're not taking care of either one, you're dramatically increasing your risk. We look at social connectedness, isolation versus engagement. We look at the kind of mental cognitive stimulation that comes from being involved with activities. You know, retirement's not for everybody. Mm. And some people retire from life rather than from their jobs. Mm-hmm. And that's not good. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at that, and also chronic depression, because we know that anxiety, depression that goes untreated is a problem. We also look at some of the things people do, unfortunately, to treat their depression and their anxiety. Do you know that if you take a benzodiazepine, an anti-anxiety medication, for more than 90 days, you have a risk of increasing your likelihood of dementia? So all those people out there saying, well, it's just Xanax. you know, it's just Valium. It's just, you know, I'm just using this to feel a little better, may actually be getting in the way of their brain's future.
Can you also add sleeping medications to that?
Oh, yeah. The over-the-counter things, the ones that are just the PM. How bad could it be? It doesn't require a prescription. I'm sorry. It includes diphenhydramine, otherwise known as Benadryl. That will suppress your thinking abilities. We're also thinking that, you know, what is now legal in many states, marijuana, may not be so good for the brains of people who are over the age of 65. Maybe they used to consume when they were in their 20s, but chances are back then they were, number one, 40 to 50 years younger. Mm-hmm. Consuming marijuana, that was about one-fifth the intensity, the strength of what they're now using. The old marijuana is about 4% THC. The new stuff is 18 to 30%. I don't like the math.
No.
So you have fewer circuits because we've gotten older, consuming much more of an intense kind of mind-altering product, not so good. Then you have what you can get anywhere at any time in most places, alcohol. And we know that it's small quantities, not so bad for us. Large quantities, cause of dementia. And then we also talk about, there are several blood levels, things that people don't even think about. We test for things like vitamin B12 and B9. We're maybe not testing so much for iron. We may not be testing so much for homocysteine and methylmalonic acid, which can impact the way in which those vitamins are basically broken down and used by our brains.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, there's this whole model built chapter by chapter. We walk people through the science, talk with them about how this all works. Then we have the questionnaire to give them a chance to say, okay, what is my blood pressure? And what is my BMI, my body mass index? Am I of a normal weight or do I need to do something about it? And we go through and have them assess themselves in all these different areas or get the information they need from their doctor or for somebody else. And that then provides them with a road. Now they can say, okay, where do I want to start? Perhaps most importantly, the last three chapters of the book talk about how to make changes and why change is important. You know, we think about change as being so natural growing up. We sell, she's rolling over. Look, he walks. He's able to run. He's going to first grade. He learned to read. She's able to do that math problem. They're driving cars. And we celebrate all those wonderful changes. And then we get into midlife and we decide, we're done. We're perfect. We're cooked. I'm not changing anymore. Yet the role to successful aging, as I think you already know, but I'll just reiterate, is adapting.
Yeah.
Changing and maintaining or improving on what we've got. And people stop doing that. They lose the ability or the motivation or the adaptability to make a change. And yet, that's what it's all about at this point, is how do I up my game? Because that's what's going to make the difference.
One of my favorite visuals is that it's midlife and beyond, healthy aging after midlife is the Olympics of change, adapt, and grow. Or don't do anything and basically just slide off the edge of the earth and die, right? Like you're going to slide downhill or you're going to stay the same or even perhaps in some cases get better for people that have never really loved exercise or didn't really take care of themselves, but they got a wake-up call or they heard something like this and they said, I don't want to have dementia. What do I have to do? And then they get into the game. So you're right about that. It's all about change.
We have to support that because it's hard.
Yeah.
You know, we get set in our ways and we sort of, it becomes what they call cognitive dissonance. I've been doing it this way for so long that since I want to be okay, what I'm doing must be okay. So you're suggesting I change, which means, was I really not okay? And that's scary for people.
Yeah.
A lot of times I like to tell them some new facts because there's a lot of new science coming out. So for example, we got people who've got hearing loss. And they say, well, I hear well enough. Like, you know, the people just need to speak up. They're mumbling. And I say, well, here's a fact you may not have known, because this is pretty brand new stuff. Hearing loss, we now see as a cause for memory loss. We can see this on very specific kind of MRI scans showing the thickness of a surface of our brain called the auditory association cortex that connects to the memory centers. We also can see through another type of science called functional MRI that people with hearing loss don't get alerted well enough to things in their environment. They have a downgrading of something called the salience network. So I wouldn't expect you to know this before, but now that you know it, don't you think you ought to get a hearing test? Because maybe we could improve this and avoid decline. And now they're hooked because now they're able to get away from saying, well, I've always been this way. I can't change, and say, well, I didn't know this before. That makes sense. I'm going to go and do this. And that's where science really can help us.
Oh, absolutely. And I, you know, not everybody's a science geek. I happen to love science. But I'm reminded of how common joint replacements have become. And yet 20 years ago, I don't know how many years ago, it really was sort of a new thing. And gosh, I'm going to have a whole new knee and that's scary. And I don't know. And now it just seems like everybody gets a joint, a hip replacement or a knee replacement. And so the point being, what used to be scary and strange and I don't know, now is becoming more common. And there was an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks, months ago, about how hearing aids have become hip because so many young people have hearing loss, like in their 20s and 30s, because of listening to loud music or whatever. They work in busy environments, so they don't hear as well. And they bling them out and they do all this stuff. But I know people my age are like, I have to get a hearing aid. No, I don't want that, right? Because we see it as some kind of downfall or you know, we're getting old and that's horrible. Gosh, I don't want to miss anything. If I was told I had to have hearing aids, I think I'd be going out to get them.
I would say to people, you know what makes you sound and look old? And they said, what? I said, yeah, exactly. What?
What?
That really makes you look old. I said, the hearing aids, you can't even see. They're so small.
I know.
A woman, they're going to go under your hair. Nobody's going to know that you're wearing them unless you tell them. But once you get them, you're going to start telling people because it's such a cool kind of new apparatus that you're going to want them to know, hey, I got this hearing aid. I can adjust it on my cell phone. I can now turn somebody down or turn them up. I can hear halfway across the room. This is really cool.
As a matter of fact, I'm turning you down right now because I don't want to hear from you anymore. That's funny. I didn't know they were that cool technologically that you could adjust them on your phone.
Oh, yeah. They're amazing. And you can adjust them presets. They're set up for different environments. Like restaurant is different than a concert hall. It's different than a one-to-one conversation. They're getting increasingly cheaper. A really, really good pair of hearing aids. Now it's about $1,500, $1,600. And self-charging, digital. They're incredible. They're going to get better because it's getting more competitive now.
Well, more of us getting into that stage of life where we might need hearing aids, the demand is greater. The market is going to respond.
Yeah, rock and roll has been a really good thing for the hearing aid industry.
That's true. That's true. So what else do we need to know about dementia prevention? I want to ask you what you would tell people who are afraid to go take your quiz. Because they might find out. So there's two things. Your quiz is going to talk about where we are in the prevention spectrum. For people that, you know, you were saying we should make it routine once a year for your wellness check, you're going to get a check-in for your brain and how it's functioning and things like that. I know people that don't want to know.
I get out. Me too. I tell them that the the ostrich who buries his head usually gets run over by the truck if he's in the middle of the road. And that it's not going to do anything but give them information that they can then use. Better to know than, because there are things we can do. You know, if I get someone who comes into my office with mild cognitive impairment, so they're just a step below normal, they don't really have dementia yet. Well, we can do a lot of these interventions that'll make a difference. And in many cases, 2 years later, they're back to normal again. But if they come in with mild dementia and we add some of currently available memory medications to that prescription, then they get back to being mild cognitive impaired again from dementia. Emily and I did a study back in the early 2010s that we presented at the 2014 American Academy of Neurology Convention. And we followed some 700 patients between our two practices. So I was seeing people referred in from the community, from neurologist primary care doctors. She had her own medical practice of people she was treating and really looking at all of these aspects, which later became our dementia prevention program. Both groups had equal numbers of people on medication for dementia. They came in at a level of about mild dementia initially. So we followed them over 2 years. The group that had her enhanced approach, which was focused on a lot of different medical things that could be corrected, including sleep disordered breathing, sleep apnea, which was at that point not being looked at by the PCPs or the neurologist at nearly the level they should have. Within 6 months, her group on a standardized repeated test was better than it had been when it started, significantly better than the group that was being followed in the community. That gap got wider over the next year and a half, because we followed these people for 2 years. Got wider over the next year and a half because the group that was not in her program got worse. Her patients stayed the same. So I tell them, if you come in at a point where, and this is not just unique, that science is out there, and it's just a question of really applying it and taking the things we're doing in dementia prevention, adding some medicines. These have been out since the late 1990s. FDA approved, generally safe, well-tolerated, but because they don't reverse dementia, people tend to poo-poo their benefits. You know, it doesn't make you better. Or they'll take them for a couple months and the doctor will say, well, your memory better? No. Well, maybe you don't need to take it. Wrong idea. Yeah. It's sort of like I get a flu shot every year and generally I don't get the flu. Was that because I got the shot or was that because I was lucky? And my answer is, I don't care. I didn't get the flu. Yeah. That was the goal. So we know statistically that people who take these medicines will have a slower decline or no decline. Mm. At least with other things, we start to get improvements in a segment of our population. So the earlier you start, the earlier you recognize it. I view the dementia at this point in most patients as a chronic medical condition as opposed to a terminal medical condition. Mm.
Well, that's certainly heartening news. And back to the ostrich analogy, I always say once you've heard it, you can't unhear it. And like you said, you told the person the one fact about hearing and dementia, and then they were like lit up, right? So These kinds of things are heartening because most of us don't know whether we're going to be the one who gets dementia. So why not start taking advantage of the prevention so that we don't have to find out whether we were the one that was going to get dementia?
We're just trying to stack the deck in your favor.
Yeah.
There are some cases, we talk about that also in the book, there's some cases, people we see who've done all the right things and they still declined. They still got worse. They took the medicines, they exercised, they ate well, they had good relationships, they didn't have hearing loss, they did all these things. You know, it just happens. We can't fix that. Right. Maybe medication at some point, maybe gene editing, CRISPR technology, maybe something that's an inoculation. I don't know what the future is going to hold, but if we could reduce the incidence of dementia by 50%, that would be a game changer.
Absolutely. So Mitch, I'm going to refer to you from now on as the Brain Doc and remind people that your website is braindoc.com. And you can learn more about Mitch and his wife, Emily. You can buy the book through their website. You can take the quiz to find out where you are on the prevention pathway, I guess I'm going to say. Yeah. And why not get on the prevention pathway?
Can I plug the title one more time?
Because
it's
available
on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all these different places, as well as Kindle, Apple, iPad, and audiobooks. Nan McNamara does a great job of reading our book for people like to take a walk and listen or take
I
a ride.
I love audiobooks.
The book is Dementia Prevention, Using Your Head to Save Your Brain, published by Johns Hopkins Press, where you have to leap through science hoops that you wouldn't believe because they don't want to put anything out that isn't real science.
Yeah, I'll bet.
We're real proud to be part of their group and to be published by them.
Yeah, congratulations. I know that they have a very high standard. Anything you want to leave our listeners with? I think you've covered a lot of territory for us.
As usual, I talk a lot. Okay. Big job, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of brains to save out there. I just want people to take a different approach to this. I don't want them, as I said at the beginning, don't worry. Don't be a dementia warrior. Be a prevention warrior. Today's the day to start. Do something.
Excellent. Thank you very much, everybody. I hope you'll take Dr. Kliansky's advice. And I'll be back next week with another fabulous guest. Thank you so much, Nick.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. I hope you've enjoyed that episode. And I thank you for listening. I'd love to connect with you on social media if you happen to play over there on Instagram and Facebook. I'm at RebelWell50. LinkedIn, of course, is my name. And on TikTok, just look for the Rebellious Wellness Over 50 page. And I look forward to connecting. You know, this is a big year of connection for us. This is how we get through tough times, is being in community with like-minded people. And if you're a listener, I believe we are.